let me start with, you guys had a nice little, a time in Sundance with this, getting the grand jury nomination.
Geez, I don't think we got a grand jury nomination, not that I recall. I was thrilled to be in Sundance. Yes, that was just wonderful, just wonderful.
What as far as the festival circuit, you know, you've kind of taken this film, you know, around. You even got, you know, to Athens and with Philly with it.
Yes.
How have the...
Well, you know, Sundance is such an incredible place to open a film. And, I mean, it just, it's an amazing experience to see so many of my colleagues there with just such amazing films. And this year has been, we've had great, there have always been great documentaries around, but I have to say, I feel this year is just extraordinary with the amount of talent, you know, amazing films that my colleagues have made. And I'm thrilled to be part of the class of, you know, 2018. I feel like that's, I'm graduating again or something like that. It's remarkable the kind of blossoming of documentary films that we've seen in the last, you know, in the last decade or two. It's just really moving and essential to the life of our, the life of our cultural world today, because so many documentarians are taking on themes, stories, people, issues, ideas that are not handled in the, you know, sort of the mainstream media. And these are films that are made of passion, and that take a long time in many cases to make, and that span, in some cases, many years. So, you know, I think audiences are, to see audiences embracing them the way they are this year, you know, of course, on the various outlets that there are plenty of new platforms, but also in theaters, is really wonderful to see these films in theaters is essential, because that is, you know, an opportunity. A film like the films that we're seeing coming out this year, they're cultural events, and people get together in groups, and they talk about questions, issues, ideas, and ultimately that's how, you know, that's how we keep our democracy alive, is conversation. Even with people we don't necessarily agree with.
So what made you want to dive into this side of the art world, or the financial side of it?
Well, let's see, you're in Dallas, right? So my father has a museum there in Fort Worth, the Kimball Art Museum, and I made a film, My Architect, which was out, you know, over a decade ago, but which certainly played, I had some marvelous experiences in Texas with it, bringing it there, and I feel like Texas is kind of a second home. I don't know Dallas as well, don't know Houston as well, or Austin, or, you know, any of that amazing large state, but I do know Fort Worth, and I feel that there's a you know, just an incredible community there, and having made My Architect and been so warmly received there with the film, you know, I'm thrilled to have a film coming back there now. And, you know, 15 years after making My Architect, some of the themes that are in that film are about the relationship between art and money. And my dad had, you know, a big struggle with that, because, you know, art takes time. And we have this phrase that time is money, which I don't agree with in any way. Time is just time, especially for an artist. And, you know, when time is money, we run into problems in our world. In many cases, certainly when it comes to artists. So I touched on some of those themes of how difficult it is to really do great work if you're concerned mainly with the bottom line. But, you know, since the time of making that film, the contemporary art market has just taken off. And it's just this financial behemoth that is, you know, that is barreling forward. We see, you know, headlines all the time of you know, auction headlines of paintings and works of art selling for, you know, astronomical figures, tens of millions of dollars, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars. And I was fascinated by that. I mean, it's a very interesting phenomenon, and I sense that there's something new here going on. It's you know, art and money have always been connected, but not to this degree. So, you know, something which is both fascinating and also kind of terrifying, which I find this phenomenon both things, makes for a good subject to make a movie about. I want to be clear that to make something like this also requires amazing access and knowledge. And this is where the producers of the film I was very lucky to have producers who had connections within the art world. So the producer, Jennifer Stockman, for instance, has been in the art world for 15 years, or more actually, but been chairman of the board of the Guggenheim for 15 years. So she was able to bring to the table enormous knowledge and access to people in the art world, which you see that appear in the film. So I'm able to take you back, that, you know, behind the scenes, you see an auction being put together at Sotheby's. We meet artists in their studios, some of which are, you know, people like Jeff Koons, Marilyn Minter, George Tondo, you know, people who are very much part of the art market, the current art market, very much part of that scene today. And also, of course, very prominent collectors and dealers. So that access, which I was able to get for the film through Jennifer and through the producers, was completely essential to my process. And then also, of course, there are artists in it who were not part of that system, and Larry Koons, who we found later in the game after I'd already begun making the film. I realized I really needed to find an artist who had been part of this kind of market system, but then for whatever reason rejected that, and or was rejected by it. But a person who continued to make work in spite of the fact that, you know, they were not the quote unquote market artist. And Larry's story, Larry Koons was a very famous artist in the 60s, part of the, you know, the group that broke through in that period, contemporary artists who were not only shown in galleries, but also picked up by the marketing system. And at that time, the key gallerist, Leo Castelli, in New York, picked Larry up. And then the work that he was doing, his style evolved. The work he was doing changed. And the marketplace said, no, keep making what you were making. That was selling so well. Keep doing that. And Larry said, you know, not so many words, but with his work, said, no, I'm evolving, man. Don't tell me what to do. I'm an artist. I need to follow what I believe. I need to follow my heart and my hand and my eye. And in so doing, you know, he fell out from that world for a long time. So we encounter him in the film in upstate New York, where he has a studio, you know, very much off the grid and doing phenomenal new work that has nothing to do with his original work. And so the story, Larry's story of his intersection as an artist with the market also is threaded through this film. And I guess I would say that I find in Larry Koons a figure that reminds me a little of my dad, in the sense that this is a person who, you know, I mean, I think all the artists in the film, don't get me wrong, are extremely committed to the work that they're doing. But to different degrees, the market may or may not shine its white hot light on you. And you have to keep doing it no matter what. You have to do it whether you're successful or whether you're not successful. People like that fascinate me and inspire me. So Larry was a very key, component of making this film work as a kind of kaleidoscopic experience of what is going on right now in the contemporary art world.
Was there almost a catharsis in meeting Larry and getting his story put on screen?
Catharsis, interesting. As a filmmaker, I'd say it was more a relief because I realized in meeting him that I had met someone who really gave the film a deep soul, a deeper soul, in the sense that I think that every film really, you know, a film needs to progress through contrasts. And this film, especially because there's so many characters, the contrast between the characters was completely essential to making it work. In fact, the structure of the film really operates around contrasts. So we move between scenes that involve people who are making art, people who are buying art, people who are selling art, that's people who are making art. And it's kind of this triangle. We flip between those poles in a way in the film. And having someone like, you know, but you also need, that kind of creates a sort of tension in the film, but you also need through lines, you need threads, which sort of draw a much longer line through a film. And Larry's story, which has to do with where he is now, where he was then and where he is going. And by the end of the film, something really wonderful happens in his life. He has a major show. That arc, that story thread, that story arc actually gives the film a much sort of stronger structural through line. So yes, it was a relief in a way. It was definitely a relief to find him and a kind of confirmation that we were on the right track, that by looking at, you know, these various aspects of the art world, sort of, we knew we needed something, and then in finding Larry, we found it. And I guess, I mean, you used the word catharsis. Yes, I suppose there is that too, which is the sense that ideas and feelings that I have about, you know, just sort of deep down about the role of the artist and the life of the artist was able to come out, was able to be revealed, which is, I think, that in the end, the artist wishes to connect and wishes to make a connection with another. It doesn't have to be a huge group of people. It can be another single individual. But it is this desire for commonality and for connection that, you know, drove Larry even in you know, in the kind of the isolation that he experienced. I will say, he's very lucky to have a partner, Paula, who is also an artist, and the two of them, you know, face the world together. That's also something that was very beautiful to see, that relationship between husband and wife, both of whom are artists, but who help each other deal with some of the beauties, but also the cruelties of the world.
So I've got to ask, I loved, you brought up about the structure of the film. One of the things I loved was the pacing, and especially, you're getting the composer, Jeff Beal, I think his work is so subtle and gorgeous at moving us along in such a wonderful way. Can you talk about getting involved on the, you know?
I'd love to. Thank you so much for bringing that up. I mean, I work in a community of artists. I'm not a solo practitioner. You know, I've mentioned the producers, but also I have, you know, incredible collaborators in Bob Richmond, the cinematographer, and Sabina Grimejewel, the editor, the other editors I work with, Brad and Philip, and of course, the sound man, you know, Eddie O'Connor, who's so important. I mean, these people, each one of them brings something to the table. And when you're done putting all this thing together, your movie still many times feels like a kind of, you know, a series of parts. And you know, what is it that's going to actually pull this whole thing together? And in so many ways, that is the last, you know, one of the last components is the music. Now, in fact, it isn't really the last component, because you've been temping music all the way along, using music, you know, that you dream to have along the way, and you put it in there on your editing table. But many times, you know, you can't afford the music, or you can't get a composer who can do those sorts of things. Or, you know, but I knew that Jeff Beal, having worked with him before, Jeff is an absolute, he's an incredible composer and an incredible musician and a treasured friend and collaborator. And Jeff has done, you know, having done Pollock, the film Pollock, but also having done House of Cards, and having done, you know, so many shows as well, you know, as well as films. But he is somebody who is a master of many, many moves and many, many sort of ways of creating atmosphere. And so I knew that Jeff was somebody who would really get the pacing of this film, that it moves quite quickly. And we wanted it to move rather quickly, and we wanted it to have a kind of underlying tension to it, because there is sort of this sense of foreboding almost with this, this auction that's coming up, and also this sense that, you know, in a sense that our culture is headed towards some kind of edge where money is ruling the day, and art is struggling in a way to retain its sense of intrinsic value against the onslaught of money and of capitalism, which tries to turn everything into a commodity. And that tension there is a difficult thing to express, and it needed musical themes to do it. Jeff brought those to the table, and the gifts of his music are just, you know, are boundless and varied. He's also able to create a kind of bittersweetness, and there's a piece which recurs. One of the things that I love about working with Jeff is he will create themes that can then be slightly modified and that can recur film, so you'd hear something familiar, something you've heard before that is now slightly different, tinged with a sadness or tinged with joy, or something, you know, something shifts just a little bit, and everything, you feel differently. So Jeff came up with a number of themes which are threaded through the film, and one of them is kind of a sweet, bittersweet theme, which we use a number of times, which comes back. You know, and sort of as the film goes on, you begin to feel something differently about certain, perhaps certain kinds of art, even certain personages in the film, and the music helps you to kind of sense how that's changing. You also have there is also Jeff composed an amazing waltz and dance, and I think of this kind of relationship between art and money as being a dance. The film begins with this waltz, this sort of dance music, as you see works of art coming around and being auctioned and the hammer coming down, the people moving. It feels like a dance. It felt like a dance when I filmed auctions, and Jeff totally got that and worked with it, and it's absolutely magnificent. That theme also comes back a couple of times in the film. There's an auction in the beginning, which is just presented as a dance. You don't really understand it. By the end, you know, you just kind of see it and sense it. It washes over you, this escalating numbers and everything. And then by the end, the waltz, the theme comes back, and now you understand it more. You understand the components of the dance, who the dancers are, who's off stage, who's on the other end of the phone, all these different things. So working with a composer at the level of Jeff is not only a joy, but it makes a film work. It actually knits it together and finds a way to make it a cohesive whole. Finally, Larry Coons is also a musician, as well as being a motorcycle racer. But he's a musician, and he plays the guitar for us towards the end of the film. And, you know, in that sense, there are a number of reasons why I wanted that. And one of them, of course, was that he refers many times to music throughout the film. He refers to Beethoven, he refers to Hank Williams, he refers to musicians often, Von Weber, and their fates. And somehow he often flies to those metaphors, even more than visual ones, musical ones. For instance, just the idea that in Beethoven, the first piece is so, Opus 1 is so different from his last piece. I mean, you couldn't imagine the evolution of that artist. And of course, Larry sees that in his own work, that he wants to evolve. He doesn't want to get stuck doing the same thing for the rest of his life. But so at any rate, he is also a singer and a songwriter and a musician. So he plays a piece of Hank Williams for us. And there's actually a Hank Williams, of course, piece is central to my architect as well. He plays a Hank Williams piece called Pictures from Life's Other Side. And as he's playing it, we see Larry, first we see him playing it, and then we see him headed with Paula on his arm towards his opening of his show, which is sort of a show very towards the end of the film, and it's been a long time in coming, this show. And we see him walking, and the music, what Jeff did is he took the theme, the Hank Williams song, Pictures of Life on the Side, and he orchestrated it and transformed it into something that becomes this orchestral, beautiful, sort of, kind of lyrical piece of music, which overarches the sort of ultimate scene in the film, in which we now see many of the, even after the artists are gone, we're seeing the art sort of on the wall floating by, and the idea that art, you know, people, empires, rich and poor, every, all of the travails of this earth that we are now experiencing, they pass away. What is left from our moment in the end is art. And so Jeff made that work. Of course, it also contrasts wonderfully with some of the music which we use throughout the film. Like there's some wonderful pieces of Little Walter, whose music just has such fantastic energy and edge. And Jeff's lyrical piece there at the end bumps up against the title sequence, which is art, the credit sequence, which is art being put into storage, which is one of the problems today, is that much of the art that's bought is bought as speculative instruments. It's almost like it's a financial instrument. You have your stocks, your bonds, your art. And we see at the end some art being carted away and put into storage. And over that is this amazing Little Walter piece that also has kind of a bite and an edge to it. So the lyricism goes up against the, you know, let's not forget what we're up against here. So the music is utterly essential to the process of making films, and to work with a great composer like Jeff Beal is just is one of the great joys of my job.
Well, to kind of wrap things up on my last question here, I'd love to know, Nathaniel, about the choice in title, the Mr. Wilde's quote. I know you use the one half of it, and it's also in the movie as well. One of the artists brings it up. Can you talk about, you know, the title being a very important kind of also look back at the entire art world in maybe a more cynical way, but very much a way that says, you know, who is determining the value of this, and how that's, you know, has changed and is changing.
Sure. Just one second here. Just one second. The film's title is The Price of Everything, and that is out of a book from Oscar Wilde, which is from the play Lady Windermere's Fan, in which a character, Lord Darlington, says a cynic is a person who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. So when one of our most fascinating character in our film, Stefan Edlis, the great collector, says, sort of quoting it, but turning it into his own quote, nowadays, you know, or he said, there are a lot of people out there who know the price of everything and the value of nothing. It just struck me as being so much what this film is really about, which is that that ultimately there is a fundamental difference between the financial cost of something and its value. And if there's sort of one of the main things I hope that people take away from this film, it's that to remember that the price of something is not the same as its value. Those things are fundamentally different. And ultimately, art, its greatest value is intrinsic. It's not financial. And there have been great paintings that have been sold for great amounts of money. There are great paintings that have been sold for nothing. And they're, you know, works of art that have passed away and nobody even remembers, that were sold for lots of money, and works of art that passed away that were sold for not a lot of money. So the price of something fluctuates with taste, with the day, with the moment, with the competition. It ultimately is not the same thing at all as the value of a work of art. And if you go to some of those, you go to the Kimball Art Museum, and you stand in front of some of those paintings there. You stand in front of the incredible, I believe it's a Duke show, I may have it wrong, but there is a painting of Lazarus coming out of the tomb and rising out of the tomb, and you look at those figures there, and you look at one of them who has pulled a cloak over his nose because obviously Lazarus has been dead. And there's a smell in the air. You look at that moment, the brilliance of that artist capturing that moment, that you know, incredible sort of scene from the Bible, from, you know, however you want to see it, whether you believe it happened or you believe it's a story, whatever it is, it's an incredible moment that is captured right there. That is the work of an artist. That is somebody who understood that moment fundamentally and created the feeling for it hundreds of years ago, and it reaches us now. How can you put a price on that? That is priceless. That is something that has value that far transcends any monetary value you put on it. So, in the end, art is telling us, reminding us, that money, as useful as it is, not the most important thing in life.